for the next section of the afternoon, I'm going to turn things over to our immediate past president, Jeff Tom.
Okay, thank you, Judy. Am I being heard?
You are.
Okay, great. So I am going to present to you a panel on meeting the unmet need for services to seniors with vision loss. And in reality, it's not just seniors that require a lot of these services. You know, folks with vision loss that is recent in origin, and even those who have had no vision for a long time also need these services. So my panel is a real stellar group, I think, and I think you will agree by the end of this panel. First, to introduce my panelists, we first have Shalina Heber. Shalina is the new Chief Executive Officer of Valley Center for the Blind, and the folks down in Fresno really sing her praises. Our second panelist is Claire Ramsey. Claire is an attorney at Justice on Aging, which is one of the leading senior advocacy organizations in the country. Claire has been a leader on the Long-Term Care Services and Support Subcommittee for the Governor's Master Plan, on which I serve, and I can tell you she's just great. Thirdly, we have Sherry Raisler, who is the CEO for the Sacramento Society for the Blind. And not only has Sherry turned that organization around in a major way, but she is also extremely interested in advocacy and works hard in that regard. And finally, someone that probably about, I would say, 90% of you out there know. We have a few non-Californians and maybe a few who don't know him. But we have the director of the California Department of Rehabilitation, Joe Xavier. So I'm going to, they've received some questions in advance, and I'm going to tell you that the last question is slightly changed, so be prepared for that. I am going to throw out a name when I ask each question, and then others who want to chime in can do so. And so we have five questions, and if we have more time, which I hope we will, we can have questions from the audience, but let's see where we go. So question number one, is funding for specialized services for seniors with vision loss is estimated to meet not more than 3% of the need. California's share of such federal funding is only $3 million, and there is little expectation that funding under this program will increase in the near future. What thoughts do you have on ways that we can acquire additional revenues for these services? And for my first guinea pig, I'll throw it to Sherry.
Thank you, Jeff, I guess. No, welcome, everyone. It's great to be with you and with Joe and Shalina and Claire. Glad to be on this panel with all of you and everyone else that's joining us. And that's a great question, Jeff, and I think it's one that all of us have been tussling with for some time. And, you know, heading up a nonprofit, I think we all know that we have to always be looking at how are we diversifying those assets that we have to run our programs. And you know, we haven't seen an increase in the OIB funding for quite some time. And so I think that one way of generating more revenue, even though we know in these times it can be challenging, is really looking at the investment in our resource development fundraising programs. What can we do to raise private dollars to support our programs? And I think it's also really important to look at private and public partnerships. Where can we work together with other organizations, other businesses to sponsor, underwrite some of what we're doing for our senior programs, while also advocating for more funding at the federal and state level? And in that, I really believe in a big tent approach to that, where we really partner with other agencies serving people who are older, whether it's, you know, Claire's organization, Leading Age, California, Leading Age is all over the country, Alzheimer's Association, all those big agencies. I think coming together with a big voice about what's needed will, I think, serve us all better, even while we all do have our unique advocacy needs that we also want to focus on. So I guess that would be my ideas on how we can work to increase some of the funding that we all need. I mean, our allocation from OIB covers maybe 50% of the services we provide to 16 counties.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else have any thoughts from the panel?
Jeff, this is Joe. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Well, first of all, good afternoon to everyone across the state, and it sounds like maybe beyond the state. And congratulations to CCB to pull together probably your first virtual conference. Not an easy feat, but admirable, and really speaks to the times that we're in. And Sherry, I'd just like to add a couple thoughts to what you've already started. I think that one of the things that we should consider, particularly in the environment that we find ourselves in, is to shift our mindset a little bit from looking at bringing more money into, quote, the OIB system, and shift it to bringing expertise from the OIB system and to other systems that can be of service to the population that are losing their vision later in life, people that need that service. One such area is the health industry, and thinking about some of the things, some of the technology that is available, as well as some of the devices that people that are blind need, as well as some other aspects of the health industry and the insurance industry that we could be leveraging to serve this population, I think would be something that would behoove us. And again, particularly in the environment that we find ourselves in of some major budget shortfalls, which are likely to be multi-year.
Okay. Anyone else care to take a crack?
This is Shalina. It's such a privilege to be here to share a perspective on this important topic. And it's an honor to be on a panel with such incredible advocates and champions for our community. And so also my deep appreciation to CCB for including me, and to echo Joe, congratulations. We all know from our experience the last few months that coordination of technology like this can be a big challenge. And CCB, you made it happen, and it's just really fabulous. This topic is so important for our agency in particular, because VCB was founded as Friendship Center for the Blind. Our mission at that time was specifically to serve seniors with vision loss to receive services that fill those unmet needs. In our mission at the time, we embraced social inclusion, togetherness, physical recreation as core tenets of our mission. I was just on the phone with our founder actually this past Wednesday, and her passion for seniors with vision loss, even though now she lives in Pennsylvania and is running a nonprofit there that kind of fills this mission, that passion for seniors is undeniable and ongoing. And I, for one, am serious about the intense gap in senior services. You know, we're taking a critical look in our own agency as to how we can work more holistically towards services, but there is that constant funding struggle. So for me and VCB, our thought is that with collective advocacy as entities that are interested in doing what we can to help individuals with vision loss, we should be able to work together with lawmakers to be able to try and resolve this gap. You know, Sherry brought up private funders and foundations, and it is so imperative that we all have those strong relationships in the community. But sometimes I struggle with asking a foundation or a donor to directly fund programs that are providing basic needs for Californians with disabilities, because there are so many other programs that we could do that would be innovative, that are serving more than just those basic needs. So it would be my hope that as we move forward and all get closer and are more organized, that you know, our voices individually only carry so far. But with the united and collaborative appeal, we might be able to work together with California in a different and innovative way than we have in the past, and make a real splash in our state in creating some funding that helps fill this gap.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go on to our second question. And this is a question that probably everyone on the Zoom platform today and listening in on ACB Radio has probably thought about in some way, shape, or form. And I'm going to let our panelists give us their thoughts. What societal impacts do you think the COVID-19 pandemic will have on seniors and people with disabilities generally, and seniors with vision loss specifically? What will be the impact on service delivery systems? And I'm going to start this time with Joe.
Thank you, Jeff. So let me start this with a real story. So my 89-year-old mother, who barely speaks English, was about as digitally illiterate as you can imagine in December of 2019. In June of 2020 today, she is using an iPad to live stream Mass all by herself. I think that highlights the evolution that COVID-19 is forcing upon all of us. It has majorly escalated trends that were already underway, and it is creating opportunities for remote services in ways we never would have conceived of, let alone tried just a mere 4 or 5 months ago. There's truly a positive collision taking place between COVID-19 and artificial intelligence that once we have a better understanding of and learn how to harness, I think will offer some real possibilities to change the way that we deliver services. And please don't hear any of this as a replacement for human-to-human contact. I think it's an augmentation of that human-to-human contact. After all, the reality that any of the people that we serve is somebody that we are touching every day, let alone hours within every day, probably not practical. So these are ways of expanding the impact of our services, as well as expanding the services and service delivery from here and moving forward. And I would expect that it will evolve considerably in the next 6, 12, 18 months.
Okay. Anyone else?
This is Claire. I haven't had a chance to thank everyone for having me here today. Really nice to be with all of you, and thank you to CCB for inviting me. When I read this question that Jeff sent, I felt a little bit like this is probably going to be like a bunch of college students' term papers topics next semester, because it's such a big, meaty question and one I think we're going to be grappling with for years. But, you know, I was thinking kind of across the different service delivery models, and I think one of the things that we're going to see a big broad push about is sort of how we really talk about deinstitutionalization on a much broader level for older adults, and how we look at congregate care and also congregate settings, given the safety concerns, given the you know, real devastation that's happening in nursing homes. I do feel like we're going to have different conversations about how people can age safely at home and in the community without increasing isolation and loneliness and depression. I think also, to Joe's point, I think we're going to see, you know, what in the, I don't even want to say in the past, because that's probably like, you know, 4 months ago, but, you know, people have asked for accommodations for a long time and, you know, often don't get what they need. And it seems sort of like, too often it seemed like we're granting somebody a favor, or, you know, we're doing something beyond what we're supposed to do. And I think this idea that now we're seeing like, oh, there is so much technology that can be leveraged. There are so many ways that people can work successfully remotely. There are workarounds to a lot of things. I'm hoping that those are things we can carry forward as more societal changes, that we don't look at them so much as sort of someone's asking for something above and beyond, but something we build into our systems in a much better way. And then the other thing I just think, and it somewhat relates to the funding, but I think we've really started to elevate a conversation around older adults, people with disabilities, people with different sensory disabilities. Like, what do you need to be safe, to live in the world, to be part of community? And I think those are conversations that could trickle out as the pandemic stops. And I think it's going to be really incumbent upon all of us to keep those conversations going, and that to make sure this is a, everybody realizes that this is going to have large implications, both for, you know, how well we treat people, but also, you know, for ourselves, how we get to age, how we get to live with disability, and that we keep that conversation elevated even once the pandemic has, you know, makes it seem like those conversations could stop if we're not careful, but I think we need to keep them going.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else?
Real quick.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to say one thing that we've been talking about internally that, you know, might be an ongoing impact is outreach. BCB is, we're taking a real critical look at how in the past have we tried to find individuals to serve who are seniors. And I'll tell you the truth, which is that a lot of what we've done is by coordinating with senior centers and coordinating with senior independent living centers. The problem with that is we're reaching a very narrow portion of the population, and oftentimes the senior centers we're going to, they're not inexpensive to live in. And so we've recognized that along with our physical approach generally to doing outreach to find seniors to serve, we also have noticed a impact, you know, that we might not be doing the best job we could to make sure we find all seniors who need services, not just seniors who are making their way into a living facility or making their way to a senior center because they have the support to do so. So both from a COVID and what's currently going on in our society, that's something that, you know, we're real passionate about because we want to find those people who have been overlooked and undiscovered because of our narrow way of conducting outreach in the past.
Thank you. Okay, I am going to go on to the next question. And that one is, more than 80% of people with vision loss are 50 and older. Yet there is very little knowledge about the problems and needs of this rapidly expanding population among the general public. How can the blindness community increase public awareness concerning both the needs of this population and its largely unrecognized potential to live independently? And I think I'll call on, I will call on Claire first this time.
Thanks, Jeff. I mean, I think, you know, Shalina's point about outreach, I think, is a big one in terms of, you know, we sometimes think we're serving, you know, sort of our communities. And when we really look at things, we realize we're sort of serving, you know, a band of our community. And that might be because of where something is located. It might be because of who knows about the services and sort of who has a community that spreads the words about the services. And I think we have a real opportunity to think about both, you know, how to expand public awareness, but also how to do that in an equitable way. And how to really reach communities that don't typically hear about services. I think it is going to be a struggle in the world we're living in now where people are more isolated, but I do think that this is another place to really leverage technology and to leverage the possibility that we can draw communities together who might not typically be within the sort of geographical sort of narrow area where we're often relying on for people to come and get the services they need. And I also think that there's a real opportunity to sort of work, sort of the big tent idea, I think is really meaningful, and to say, you know, what other groups can we partner with that might actually be serving our community that we didn't even realize was serving them? So I'm just thinking, for example, you know, given the increase in needs for like food delivery and things like that, like, are there people that are getting food delivery that would not think of reaching out maybe for services specifically to vision loss, but actually are experiencing vision loss and could be connected in if they knew that those things existed. So I think there's ways to partner together in new ways and innovative ways and hopefully take advantage of the technologies and the new opportunities.
Great, thank you. And food delivery is definitely a point of concern during the last few months across the senior spectrum, I think, and disability spectrum. Okay, anyone else want to take a crack at this one?
This is Sherry. I just want to echo what Claire was saying about the connection. I know we called all of our current and former clients going back like two and a half years when this started, just for that reason, to say, what else do you need? You know, do you have food? Do you have other, because we knew that a lot of folks were cut off from getting access to things, transportation evaporated. And so I think that is really critical, because, you know, there are a lot, just a lot of nooks and crannies where there is need that that we are uncovering. I also think it's important with what Jeff, you are doing, and Claire also, with being at the table around the Master Plan on Aging. And we need to make sure we are at the table with other national organizations and groups that have already a very well-developed collective voice, but that we're at the table raising issues, whether it's in the field of housing or healthcare, Alzheimer's, et cetera, that people learn to understand what are some of the unique needs for our community, but also, you know, and how we can help them and also help ourselves and the people we serve to get better connected and have better, you know, access to all the expertise Joe was talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff, this is Joe.
Yes.
I mean, this is such an important topic, because this is very much ties back to the whole topic of funding. But Sherry, to your point, and Claire, your point about leveraging other systems, what we often think of seniors aging into a system, and we have to recognize that seniors are often aging in a system. The question is, are we connected to that system? So Sherry, you mentioned housing as an example. There's many other areas like that that we should be looking at. You could even be thinking about a system that's a little bit untraditional for us, but DMV. How do we connect where people are aging and then figure out how to help educate, inform, influence that system so we can bring that expertise, leverage and combine resources to really have that kind of impact? Otherwise, we're going to be continue to work to carve out the same pie in different pieces. We need to expand that pie, for lack of a better analogy, so that we have access to more resources, not just restructuring the existing resources that serve the blind community.
Okay, thank you. All right, I'm going to go to my next question. And I am going to ask this time Shalina to go first on this one. One common problem in the delivery of health and social services is that rural areas are dramatically underserved. Give your thoughts on ways to narrow the gap between rural and urban service delivery systems.
Well, Jack, if you were going to ask me a question, this would be the question to ask. Here in the Central Valley, when we talk about rural, we really mean it. You know, we're in a very ag-rich area, which brings with it significant challenges in service delivery. And a lot of centers across California do have this kind of rural and urban dynamic. And, you know, for us, some of our clients are pretty isolated on farms and only come into town every other week. Keep in mind, when I say come into town, I'm talking about their biweekly trip to one of our great farm communities of McFarland, which is a population of 15,000. And that's in between Bakersfield and Delano. So on these farms, kids are still sometimes homeschooled around the crop cycle, and access to what you think of as traditional services for seniors is non-existent, and sometimes so fills our ability to reach them. For individuals with vision loss, you know, living in these rural areas, I kind of reflected on three keys, I think, that could really help us as we move forward in this conversation on narrowing that service gap in delivery and doing what I spoke about earlier and better reaching everyone, not just the people who are easiest to reach. And I think the number one thing is that outreach. If we don't know that people exist, if we don't know that they're out there, we just know that in numbers they should be there, but we don't know where they are, you know, we can't serve them. So trying to figure out how to better outreach, how to provide information to the community as a whole, so that way hopefully it can be taken and eventually the message can trickle down to the right people, is really critical. The second, I think, issue that's really would be helpful in narrowing this gap in service delivery is transportation. I mean, we all know that that's just a huge issue in this community. And if funding were more readily available to provide transportation to seniors with vision loss, even in rural areas, that would greatly change their access to all services, not just ours. And we, you know, really feel like that could help with quality of life as a whole in a holistic manner. The third is remote training, which, like we kind of talked about earlier, in increasing our technology and in doing remote services, this has been a game changer for VCB during these challenging times. I mean, really, really, it's been interesting to see how quickly our clients, for the most part, even our seniors, were able to convert to remote training. When we first found out about this, it was a little bit of a shock and a huge concern. How are we going to keep filling the mission? But, you know, I'm certainly talking to you from home right now still as we try and work together on how to reopen as a center. And we, within a weekend, had converted 85% of our clients over to remote training without ever missing a beat. And it was astounding. And that's because we have such a fabulous team that made that happen. But, you know, some of our rural clients who were near giving up on services due to their challenges in getting to the center are now blossoming as they receive the same quality and quantity of services from our professional providers with vision loss as their urban counterparts are receiving. So I think it's got to be a multifaceted approach, but it's something that we really have to be critical about, especially, you know, here in the Central Valley. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to go to my last question. And my last question was written about a month ago. And as we know, so much has happened over the last several weeks with the tragic deaths of several African Americans and the protest, and hopefully the change that will be coming over time. Only time will tell, obviously, but these have been earth-shaking events. So in that light, I've changed my last question a little bit. Last year, Governor Newsom made seniors and persons with disabilities a priority in his future vision of California by requiring the development of an aging master plan. Gazing into your crystal balls, in light of both the COVID-19 pandemic and the recent events sounding demands for racial justice, have we lost the chance to bring about systemic changes that will impact California seniors and especially those with vision loss? Or could this be the perfect time to bring about such change? And I'm going to leave it to anyone to take on this question.
I'll give it a shot. I'll give you guys time to think, so I'll buy you the rest of the panel a few minutes so you can get your good answers. For me, I think the opportunity to make the change you described, Jeff, is better today than it was even 5 months ago. And here's why I say that. COVID-19 took an X-ray of our society, including seniors with vision loss, and has really highlighted for us so many of the gaps, some that we knew, some that we hadn't thought about. And when it highlights those gaps for everyone to see the way that people have been looking at them, it's going to allow us to really come together and take a more holistic approach to the whole person. And I think policymakers, decision makers, are more open to that today than they may even have been 5 months ago. Will it be easy? No. Is there enough funding? No. But if we do this right, if we lay the foundation from a policy and a concept perspective in terms of what a structure might look like that looks at the whole person, I think we have a real chance to make some major impact on how seniors with vision loss can continue to live in their communities with purpose and dignity, and avoid institutionalization.
Thank you. Yeah. All right.
And
anyone else?
I'm always an optimist. So I think, you know, if anything, we have to, you know, drum up that resolve and continue the passion. And we're really seeing the importance of, you know, the three legs of the stool of activism, advocacy, and policy that bring about real change. And that's what we need. And, you know, the people we serve know what we need, what they need, and all of us listening to each other, I think, can help us all, you know, move the bar and get better. And again, I really believe in that big tent approach. We're working together and coming up with new ideas, building on all the remote teaching that we have, telemedicine, you know, resources that are out there. We just have to now make sure that they get out to everyone, especially those who are in the more rural areas, in poorer communities, et cetera, so that, you know, the abilities to flourish and live independently are truly accessible to everyone.
Okay, thank you, Sherry.
This is Claire. I really appreciate that question. It feels like such a big, complicated question, partially because obviously the budget picture, which is, you know, unless I've missed something in the last half hour, which is always possible, you know, we don't have a real budget worked out yet. And there are a lot of big looming cuts. And that to me really, and Jeff, I know we've talked about this in the master plan process, that felt like a real step backwards from this idea of like a big vision, planning for 10 years, really talking and thinking about these topics, and then having all these budget cuts proposed felt very scary, and like we were going back to a place 10 years ago when we saw just so many programs decimated. But I think the shift in the last month for me, because I wouldn't say just last month, last 3 months, the COVID pandemic, I think to me has basically been able to really expose like the fact that our older adult communities, people with disabilities are not always well served and are not always thought about. And it's been a point of unfortunately a very dire reason to have to talk about it, but it's been a reason to say, you cannot ignore this community. You must talk about their needs. You must talk about how we plan, how we invest, how we support communities. And then overlaying that with the Black Lives Matter movement and all the protests, I feel like, you know, it's a very rare opportunity potentially for like radical systemic change, which is not something like I often think there's that moment in history when you get that. And I do feel like there could be that. And I think that's partially because people are trying to say, you know, it's not about tinkering around the edges of a system. It's about looking at a system and being like, if we are getting this outcome and that outcome is racist or discriminatory or disadvantages people of color or people with disabilities, then there's a systems problem and we need to change the system. It's not enough to, you know, do a little like, you know, a little more to the left here, a little more to the right there. It really has to be foundational. And it might mean really pulling things apart that we've taken for granted and not seen the opportunity to do that. And I'm hoping now there is that opportunity. So for the master plan, you know, whether the actual master plan becomes that thing, I don't know. But I think what we can do as advocates, and share to your point of like the stool, like the activism, the advocacy, and the policy, I think we can use all those levers now more than ever to like really make deep structural systemic change and like and work to, and I don't want to use the word hope, I really do the work to get to a system that's much more equitable and much less racist, right? Like anti-racist, not just quote unquote neutral, where people are comfortable that the system produces racist results, even if, you know, no bad intention, right? So I find this like kind of an amazing moment in history that we might actually be able to do really foundational change.
Great. Thank you, Claire. Shalene, anything to add? Or?
Well, I mean, I think that Joe, Sherry, and Claire have done such a fabulous job talking about such an important topic right now. On a really tough day I had recently, someone reminded me it's critical to just keep in mind that every change brings about a certain level of opportunity. And we have an opportunity right now on so many levels. Systemic changes don't just happen at the government level, although I completely echo what Claire said about how we might have to take a look at, you know, taking things apart that we've taken for granted. Those systemic changes, though, and those reforms to better help support those who have been systematically excluded or overlooked on getting the help they need, it starts here in conversations like this, and has to spread through our agencies, our legislation, our teams, our homes, and our own minds. I think one of the biggest things I've learned is to change my language and my way about thinking of discrimination a little bit, which is that, you know, we're not just not discriminatory. We are actively anti-discrimination. And I think that as a group here, we have a real opportunity to live by a core belief that there's always hope for a brighter future. And, you know, in the community that VCB serves, it would certainly be a privilege if that brighter, more inclusive future started with us. And we hope that those changes would echo in our advocacy throughout our state and hopefully our nation.
Okay, I think we probably have time for perhaps two questions of this great panel. So if somebody wants to raise their hand, Deb Kirk Lewis can recognize.
That's Mitch Pomerantz. Good afternoon.
Mitch, go for it.
Joe, I'm perhaps going to put you on the spot, but more and more of us within ACB nationally are beginning to believe, particularly since implementation of WIOA, that the older individuals with blindness program is no longer a fit within RSA, that it's become the illegal stepchild or really not wanted by the folks in RSA. I'm wondering if you foresee a time when the OIB program or perhaps some offshoot thereof ends up in the Agency for Community Living or in some other federal program where it might receive more of the funding it deserves and more attention than it's currently getting.
Yeah, I think that is something that conversations already been started about and not hard to see it happen. I would suggest, though, that simply changing the address does not address the funding. And you can look at the other programs that made that same trip. Their funding hasn't changed. So you can change an address and get some different neighbors. But if you really want to talk about changing the services the population is getting, you have to go beyond the individual system and start looking at this more holistically and start looking at how do you leverage other systems and how do you bring the specialized expertise around blindness to bring all that together. Otherwise, you just have a different start point and the same end result. I don't know that anybody is necessarily thinking that's a good idea.
Well, thank you. I certainly understand that that's not the only thing that has to happen, but it's clearly not working here. For all the years we've been trying on the national level to have funding increased, we've met a stone wall. We can't even get support within RSA under the past several commissioners. So some kind of change is definitely in order, and thank you for your comments and for being at the convention remotely today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mitch, for that excellent question.
Jordan?
Okay, we have time for another one.
Jordan?
Okay, Jordan?
There.
Hey, Jeff, I just wanted to thank you for that last question that you posed to the panel. As we must at the California Council of the Blind push for systemic change in the Black community too as well.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct, Jordan. Thank you for the comment.
You have quite a few more hands, Jeff, if you want to take, if you can take any more hands.
We can take one more, maybe two, I'll see.
All right.
Hi, Steve Mendelson here. Thank you very much for a very interesting panel. Sometimes I think that the problem begins with the fact that my injustice is somebody else's cash flow. I think we all know that dramatic change is both inevitable and necessary. And I think that broadly speaking, most of us on this call, all of us on this call, would not only favor the better alignment of resources with needs and goals, but would also probably be in general agreement as to what some of those changes should be. But when we deal with the larger political environment and the larger economic environment in which those things have to be worked out, the question becomes one of almost as much of methodology and mechanism and how to develop the kinds of consensus and the kind of advocacy tools that we need to succeed.
Is that a comment or a question?
Both.
Is that a mere question?
Both. I think it's a question.
I don't know if anybody has a rejoinder to that comment or not.
I'll just say that, you know, I mean, what I heard from that question in part was like, you know, how do we really look at revenue and how do we look at the fact that a lot of our inequities come from who has money and who doesn't. And I will say that I think there has to be, and there is already starting to be a big conversation about how do we generate more revenue as the state looks at this huge budget crisis. And I will say one thing. So I think there's a big conversation to be had about revenue and the importance of revenue. The other conversation, though, I think is important sometimes is not to put the burden on us. Sometimes when programs are getting cut, people will say, well, you know, that's too bad. But I mean, everybody has to sort of take their lumps or everybody sort of has to cut back in order. And I think it's really important for us to push back sometimes on that and to say, you know, everyone isn't taking their lumps equitably. And we can do more for the communities we're serving, especially communities of color, low-income communities, rural communities. And so, you know, it's not always incumbent upon us to say, so therefore take from this other pot or generate revenue this other way, but to really push and say, these programs are too necessary and valuable for the communities they're serving, or these new investments need to get made. We need you as legislators to figure out how to get more money into the system to support those important programs.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to try for one more question.
Okay, Livy, you are unmuted. If you can unmute yourself. And if you can't do that pretty quickly, I see that Bob can.
Okay, I'll take whoever's first.
Sure. And so Bob Acosta and Livy, there's. Okay.
I'm not muted. May I ask my question?
You're good. Yeah.
You can. You're
very
on.
Quickly. I've been in the council 63 years. That's a long time. Forgive me if I missed your answer to this question. Not only am I blind and old, but hard of hearing, but we persevere. The question is, the lady, I think, who talked about the big tent, that she favored it. In the old days, the blind fought hard for specialized services. It sounds like we're trying to do some of that today. How do we get our share from the big tent when we're a minority, a small one within a minority? Thank you.
Okay, who would like to take that on?
Well, this is Sherry. I think I was the big tent lady. But anybody else can answer as well. And I think where we start, and it's a great question, Bob, by the way, is that we have to make sure we're at the table. And I think when we look at the master plan on aging, low vision and blindness was not included in that first round of who was named to the panel. And it was some of us talking to our colleagues at Leading Age and Alzheimer's that pushed and pushed so we could finally get somebody at the table. And, you know, thankfully, Jeff got on to one of the subcommittees. But I think that's part of where we start getting the financial piece of the pie that we rightly deserve and need, is we got to get in at these tables. And I think those of us, CCB, Vision Serve Alliance, I serve on that board and Public Policy Committee, all of us need to join together and really get our public policy voice united and out there and then at these tables so we are heard, you know, and get and move the bar.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is Joe. I would just echo. You got to go upstream where policy is being set if you want to shift that funding downstream. If we're not at the tables that Sherry described, you're not going to be part of the conversation. You're not going to be part of the benefit. And they're not tables that are defined as blind, but they are definitely tables that impact the blind.
Yes, they most certainly are. It definitely, I've been very fortunate to have been on one of the subcommittees and certainly have done everything I can, you know, as part of that conversation. So I think we're going to have to, unfortunately, call it a wrap for this committee. I just want to thank this panel, and I hope that you all have come to understand why I said at the beginning that they're a real stellar group, and because I think they are. So my thanks again to Shalina, Claire, Sherry, and Joe, and let's give them a virtual round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff,
for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. This is an honor.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks, ECB.
All right. Okay, Judy, are you in door prize mode before our next speaker, or?
I think she's muted.
I think so.